When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 290. It's our April 2024 research review, where we review popular papers in the mainstream media and cool research that comes our way. In this episode, we're going to talk about two different papers and one recent podcast. We're doing a podcast react kind of situation. So the two papers we're talking about, one discusses, do genetics affect how much physical activity is needed to reduce the risk of obesity? The second is on sugar sweetened beverage tax laws and whether or not they work. And the podcast react is a critical review of Dr. Andrew Huberman's latest podcast on back pain. I appreciate that you brought this to my attention on one hand, Dr. Baraki, but I'm also sad that you brought this to my attention because now we're charged with doing this, but I think we're just heading it off at the pass. Like, people were going to ask about it, so we're just doing it before we get inundated with requests.
Yeah, I mean, it was brought to my attention, and that's how these things flow. It's the natural order of things.
Yep. Yeah, that resolution to his lot in life. It's the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. Besides this BS, you doing okay?
Yeah, started back at work in the hospital, and you know, got a little triggered enough to cover this topic on the podcast. So I just had some espresso and I'm ready to go.
Now, when you see patients in the hospital, do you often tell them to clench their fist in order to maximize force production when doing a strength test on them? Or do you have them do neck exercises while in bed?
I'm really a fan of toe spreading. So
that was my next question. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a guy growing some mold out of his lungs. And so I suggested some toe spreading exercises to help with that.
Now, do you incorporate this to your own Feet Finder account, or is this more like a separate thing? Like, I don't know how HIPAA works with respect to like pay for play type situation. Like, do you just, you know, you photograph, but it's, you know, anonymized, but that, like, that's a interesting feet kink, I think.
You're asking for a friend?
Asking for a friend. Anyway. All right. Well, look, this is going to be probably a longer episode, so let's just get right into it. Let's start with the podcast react. Again, Dr. Andrew Huberman posted a podcast. I believe the title was like Protocols to Reduce Low Back Pain and Strengthen Your Back or something like that. I don't remember the exact title. I've tried to jettison this from my brain already. I'm hoping that my hippocampus does not encode any of these memories so I don't have PTSD. But it's a two-hour podcast. I tried to film a live react to it, like just while I'm watching it and listening to it, just film my reaction to it. But I couldn't make it through all the way. One, because it's super long. And then two, there was a lot of expletives. And this is a family-friendly show. Not sure what kind of family, but a family-friendly show nonetheless. But it's a two-hour podcast. Starts out with some anatomy of the vertebral column and the central nervous system. I skipped that section because I just assume that, you know, if anything he was going to get right in the podcast, or at least not get offensively wrong, that's probably fine. So I may go back and listen to that first 20 minutes at some point to see like if there were some egregious errors. But I just assume like, oh, look, this is like straight out of an anatomy text, or at least it should be. And that's fine. Did you happen to listen to the first 20 minutes or so?
Yeah, similarly, I was not particularly like scrutinizing of that section. There are some anatomic details that he actually doesn't get quite right, but are not, don't really have huge implications for the rest of the episode, and most people wouldn't even really pick up on them anyway. So not worth our time, I don't think.
As a member of the American Association of Anatomy, the other AAA, if you will, you know, I could take issue with that and really, you know, if you can't even get the anatomy right, like, what are we talking about? But we'll give them a pass. All right. So about 1945, so right before it gets into some of the more important topics that we're going to discuss. This is a quote, direct quote, says that creating stability around the spine in a way that doesn't create compression of those nerve pathways, he says that that's important for reducing or preventing back pain. And I think that is a great way to summarize this entire sort of take on back pain, because that's very, very mechanical in nature. And so despite immediately after that statement, bringing up the biopsychosocial model and referring folks to a previous podcast that he did with a physician who's he claims is a pain expert, which may be the case. I try to avoid these podcasts as best as I can for obvious reasons that'll become clear to the listeners over the next 20 to 30 minutes. But when you bring that concept in right off the bat and you're like, yep, this is how we're going to think about things today, that making sure the spine is very, very stable and doesn't compress a nerve, already very mechanical model, and also highlights a limited understanding of like, what is the origin of low back pain? And further, like, what would we need to address if we could isolate a sort of finding? Was that your kind of takeaway when you started this? Like, was this the first cringe point that you you identified?
My first cringe point was probably the title, but this quote, and I'll say it one more time just because there's a particular point that's worth making here. It was, quote, creating stability around the spine in a way that doesn't create compression of those nerve pathways. And as you said, this is a line that is fairly representative of his approach to this topic as a whole. And I would argue even generalizes to his approach to most of the topics that he talks about on his podcast that are outside of his scope of expertise. This is a sentence that sounds good if you don't know what you're talking about. It sounds plausible, right? Of course, you want a stable spine. But if you talk to any clinician who actually deals with these types of issues, their concern, if you bring up the, you know, an issue of spinal instability, for example, is not necessarily that this patient has so much spinal instability that as a result, there is compression of nerve pathways. And as a result, I need to restore spinal stability. Spinal instability means something very different to clinicians who deal with these types of issues compared with the converse that he is alluding to here, where he's like, we want to create a very stable spine. And it's, of course, when you say it that way, everybody's like, yep, sounds good, right? The implication being that most of us are running around with not super stable spines, or if you have pain, the implication is that you probably have some spinal instability that needs to be rectified, which is not accurate in any way for the vast majority of people with back pain. And he has a number of these kinds of sentences throughout the podcast that refer to things like spinal stability or stiffness, or you want to strengthen the musculature to support your spine. Of course, that sounds good, right? But it is not correct in the context of back pain. This has been examined a lot in terms of does strength, you know, improving strength reliably improve back pain? Does a lack of strength cause back pain? What is the, is there any clear, consistent directional relationship there to be identified? And this even generalizes beyond the spine when people have looked at either strength or muscle mass around all sorts of other joints. And the relationship with pain is not nearly as strong, reliable as you would think. And especially if you want to then, as a result, recommend a bunch of exercises for the first 90 minutes of a podcast, you're focusing exclusively on exercises to quote unquote strengthen or stabilize or stiffen, all things that may sound good or plausible to you, when none of those things are particularly strongly related to the vast majority of cases of back pain. So it's just this frustrating thing where you somebody who is listening who knows anything about this topic can see straight through it, which has been the clear reaction among, you know, musculoskeletal medicine Twitter has blown up with people criticizing this for rampant inaccuracies, despite the fact that he had a huge opportunity and a huge audience to put out accurate and useful information, but instead says these kind of platitudes or trite little things that sound good if you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the less you think about it, the more it makes sense. That's the, to me, that first cringe point was not only that statement, but then the immediate sort of reference to the biopsychosocial model. Because by mentioning the biopsychosocial model, it's almost like, you know, he's waving a white flag saying, yeah. And this incorporates the biopsychosocial model fully as we currently understand it. When in reality, the remaining 1 hour and 40 minutes of the podcast effectively rejects the biopsychosocial model for the experience of pain. And it's kind of like, why did you even mention this? Was it more just like to placate, you know, all the actual clinicians in the audience if they're listening? But as an aside, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but, you know, when people ask, like, well, what do you think about Huberman's podcast or whatever? In reality, the question is, what do you think about Dr. Huberman? And I'm like, well, I don't, just as a general rule. Like, I just don't think about him. But also, who am I to, like, weigh in on the, you know, a person as a whole? I think a better question is, what do you think about this particular claim? because that is actually something that I feel might feel comfortable answering if I have expertise in that area. And so one interesting sort of exercise would be to go to Huberman's Twitter feed, and when he posts a new podcast or a particular claim, look in the comments section for actual experts in that field and see what their reaction generally is. And what happens over and over and over again with alarming consistency, likely speaking to the breadth of the audience that, you know, he gathers here, is that actual experts in the fields that Dr. Huberman wades his toes into effectively clap back at him almost immediately saying, hey, look, you got this wrong, this wrong, this wrong, this wrong. And you had this opportunity to do the right thing, but instead chose to do the wrong thing. And was this just an error of omission? Was this fraudulent? Did you actually know? Like, it is interesting kind of how that goes. But so don't necessarily take our word for it. Just trust us. Like, oh, yeah, the barbell medicine guys are, you know, coming at Huberman. And it's like, well, it's not just us. It's pretty much every expert in the space when, he goes outside of his area of expertise. And some of this is highlighted by various claims he makes that we'll address, and also just interesting sort of statements that he makes. So first off, he gets right into this McGill kind of thing. You know, he opines eloquently about Dr. McGill's sort of storied history as a spine researcher and spine expert or whatever. And he makes the claim that universally, McGill is respected in the space, and all clinicians from whatever discipline you want to choose, whether it's PT, chiropractic care, whether it's musculoskeletal medicine, whether it's, you know, trainers, athletic trainers, coaches, or whatever, everyone's like, oh no, McGill's great, which is decidedly not the case. And again, this is not me weighing in on Dr. McGill as a person, right? I do not know him personally. But if you lined up 100 professionals in each one of these different disciplines, and you ask them, hey, do you think on average that the recommendation, the advice, and the implementation of Dr. McGill's back pain work, has it been net positive or net negative? My perception of things is that you'd get a pretty even split down the middle. You'd have people on one side saying, oh, this is great. And you'd have people on the other side saying, it's maybe not the worst thing, but also there's some areas, some elements of harm. And I think the more educated and more clinical care people have had exposure to, they tend to drift towards that. I can be charitable about these recommendations and say they're not terrible, but I also find holes. Was that your kind of assessment as well?
Yeah, I similarly don't have any particular feelings towards Dr. McGill. I think he's done obviously decades of work, that a lot of the work is, you know, respectable. I think the way that has been translated into clinical practice and clinical advice, a lot of times gets taken either out of the original context or taken quite a bit too far, or people will hear, oh, nice, three exercises and I can fix my back pain. And even McGill himself objects to this sort of characterization. A few weeks or month back or something like that, he went on Peter Attia's podcast and spent a while, you know, answering questions about all sorts of topics related to back pain. That similarly, a lot of cringe inducing kind of moments and answers in that episode. And some of our other colleagues in the pain and rehab space, the guys at the E3 Rehab, they actually had Dr. McGill on their podcast afterwards to like directly kind of discuss these topics and push back and challenge him a little bit. And in that interview, he walked back a substantial amount of the claims that he made on Dr. Attia's podcast, basically saying like, you know, it was live and in the moment, and I probably should have better formulated some of my answers and things like that. So again, like, I don't claim to be an expert on Dr. McGill. One of our other friends, Greg Lehman, knows his work and his advice and recommendations quite a lot better. And there's some stuff that's good, and then a lot of stuff that may not be as, we may approach approach back pain through a different lens. And in the same way, if I'm going to be charitable to Huberman in this episode, I don't know that the episode overtly rejects concepts of biopsychosocial perspectives on pain, but rather it really just fails to recognize the importance of that kind of a view on this topic that is taken in every other modern, you know, consensus guideline on this topic. Because if you did, then if you were doing my back pain overview podcast, you wouldn't spend 90 minutes describing technical details of McGill's big three exercises. You would talk a lot more about much more significant bio and psycho and social type factors. Whereas in this episode, he doesn't ever say a word about sleep and as it relates to pain, for example, or, you know, mental health type challenges as it relates to pain or prior trauma or you know, any other number of relevant variables. If I'm taking a back pain history on somebody, getting a sense of who they are, where they came from, and what other levers I might work on, instead of, you know, describing in minute detail how to do a bird dog, and then more importantly, an ideal number of reps that's completely made up, and then the most common mistakes that people make while trying to move in a very particular way, which is also made up. So it's just reflective of the emphasis not being in the right place when approaching this, which is not terribly surprising for somebody who's not a clinician, honestly, trying to put out an overview on this topic.
Yeah. Yeah. So before he gets into like the McGill's big three exercises, because those are the first things he leads with, he kind of goes through maybe a brief sort of pathophysiology sort of lesson of like, well, what causes low back pain? And, you know, again, refers back to this mechanical model. It's like, oh, well, if you have a weakness in a particular side or area of the back, you know, that's what's causing the pain. So like if you play golf, weakness in the opposite side muscles and nerves, that's what's causing pain. And it's like, oh, not the overuse thing from just rotation based on the amount of tolerance you have for a particular volume of activity, and has that doesn't vary at all based on like sleep, previous exercise or activity levels, life stress, you know, things of that nature. It's like, oh, so it's just weakness. Okay, got
That's another nice. Perfect example, because I remember hearing that where it talks about, you know, if you're doing golf and you're always rotating in one direction, the muscles on that side get quite a lot stronger and you have a deficit on the other side. You know, and again, this is one of those things where it's like, if you have no idea what you're talking about or what you're hearing, then you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Of course you'd want to be balanced. In the same way that, oh, of course you want to be, you know, have spinal stiffness, or of course you want to have spinal stability, or of course you want to have, you know, enough strength and muscle to support the spine, all these things that just sound good. But if you actually look at, you know, evidence on interventions trying to, you know, address these factors or correlate them with pain outcomes, there is by no means a clear, consistent, or even strong relationship with most of these things and pain outcomes.
Yeah. So already I'm a little annoyed. Like at this point, I'm like 35, 40 minutes into the podcast. I'm a little annoyed, like a few cringe moments and just like, oh boy, here we go. When's like the nuclear bomb going to go off? And then it happens. All out of nowhere, he says, yeah, some people have a thick spine and other people have a thin spine. And I'm like, wait, what? We're doing somatotypes? You know, ectomorph, mesomorph, endomorph. And sure enough, he goes through excruciating detail on these somatotypes, right? And just for the people at home, like somatotypes were originally introduced to sort of characterize how people's outward appearance, their phenotype, correlates to behaviors and like feelings, experiences, things of that nature. So like, oh, if you're a thinner individual, you might be a little more meek or, you know, reserved compared to somebody who's a mesomorph who might be more outgoing, things like that, right? And so if you have that sort of background knowledge and somebody starts saying things about somatotypes, and then further extrapolates that to like thick versus thin spine, and then further extrapolates that to incidence of low back pain or risk of low back pain or particular needs for managing low back pain, your spidey senses should be tingling. They should be off the chart. Like, this sounds like BS, but maybe he'll provide some evidence to, you know, ample evidence to support such a claim. No, that never happens. He just says, yeah, some people got a thick spine, some people got a thin spine, and those, you know, warrant different approaches and different needs. If you have a thick spine, which presumably you would know by your wrist circumference or your elbow girth or knee girth, something else, you know, that means you have a lot of stability or but not enough mobility. Oh, cool. Another mechanical factor involved in low back pain incidence, risk, and management. And if you have a thin spine, you likely are real bendy. And so you need more strength and stability. And again, to the uninitiated, this might sound plausible, but again, going to look at evidence on these particular things, you'll come up empty-handed. So it's speculation at this point that if you were trying to support that speculation, you'd need to provide evidence. And if you look in the show notes and you look on his website for any sort of evidence to this, that doesn't exist. If you look on Dr. McGill, or he also references Starrett and, you know, Athlene X, Jeff Cavalieri, it's like nobody's providing evidence for this. You just said it. Like, you could delete that whole section and the podcast would lose nothing. It actually would gain something because it would be less misinformation being projected into the world. Yeah, it's kind of strange.
Yeah, I'll continue to reiterate just moments when there are claims made that sound good if you don't know what you're doing or talking about. And this is another one of those things where thick spine is stable, you need to work on, you know, mobility, or thin, you know, bendy spine has more mobility and needs strength and stability. It's like, sure, sounds great. But similarly is just completely made up. It's an attractive idea this concept of, you know, classification based treatment. If I can, you know, phenotype somebody or classify somebody into one, you know, physiologic situation or another, or one anatomic situation or another, that I might do some sort of directed treatment to better target their issue. And there are a lot of situations where that is a very valid sort of approach to treatment, right? We've talked about this on all the recent case study episodes. The whole point of making a specific diagnosis is to deliver a specific treatment. The claim here would be, if I diagnose you, if you come in with back pain and I diagnose you with, you know, back pain in the setting of, like, you know, thick spinism, that as a result, I could target my treatment to get you a little bit more bendy and mobile, and that would give you a better outcome than I would had I not bothered to make that diagnosis. Or if you came in with back pain and I'm like, wow, you're really thin, ectomorphic, you're bendy, I need to strengthen and stabilize. And if I did that on the basis of my classification, that I would get you an even better outcome. Completely made up, based on nothing whatsoever. And the corollary or the way that we would advise approaching, you know, a person with back pain in practice is not so much trying to phenotype them in this way, but rather just listening to what they are experiencing and tailoring my movement recommendations and trial and error process of trying to figure out movements that are more tolerable, less tolerable, dose them correctly based on what they're telling me, instead of saying, oh, you're looking a little thick, I need to get you bendy. If they tell me, well, it really hurts when I bend, then I'm going to say, okay, well, getting you to be able to bend a bit more is going to be our goal. Let's try to find an entry point and a dose that you can tolerate. And I would do that regardless of whether you had thick wrists or thin wrists.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is actually how it's practice changing for me. Now, instead of asking somebody their experience, I'm just going to ask for their wrist circumference, and then I'll be able to figure this out. So it goes from there, and then he goes right into the big three. So that's the curl up, the side plank, and the bird dog. I am not going to like hash out all the details like he did and like how to perform them and why they're useful, but a few interesting things do stick out. So one, when he's discussing the curl up, he says, and I quote, "If you have back pain, and even if you don't, that is probably the least efficient and probably the worst thing you can do for your back pain," when he's talking about crunches. He says that crunches on the nerve, and like that is this problematic thing. Again, making the indirect claim in this particular context that all low back pain is nerve related. You know, so you're crunching on a nerve, and if you move a certain way and you crunch on this nerve, it's going to make things worse. And it's like nocebo language, anybody? Like, I think the way he presents this stuff, even if it was factually correct, which it's not, and we're going to keep going over what's factually incorrect, but even if it was, you need to say things in such a way that do not scare people and do not make their pain potentially worse or longer lasting. And so the lack of experience in managing individuals with low back pain, it's demonstrated on full display in the podcast because of the language being used. And it's kind of like, man, it just keeps getting worse. It's like a train wreck. Like, you want to turn it off, but then you're like, I gotta keep going here.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if there's like a, if they view there being a correct technique that one must obey when they're getting up out of bed in the morning, because, you know, the movement pattern would be quite similar sitting up to get up out of bed. Oh no, like I'm going to crunch on my nerve or something like that. I need to, you know, robotically, you know, do a log roll over and get onto all fours and stand up that way or something. And, you know, if you go about your entire day and your life thinking about, you know, the precise position of your intervertebral, you know, articulations and nerve roots and things like that, that's unhelpful, not really a great way to live, certainly not a great way to recover from a bout of back pain either.
Yeah. Yeah. He goes into some more detail about how you need to do this curl up exercise. Again, even if you don't have back pain, because a stronger back is less risk of injury. And it's like, look, I would love for that to be true. Do you understand the messaging and the advertising and the market we could do around getting your back big and strong and robust, and that would just eliminate or reduce the risk significantly of low back pain incidents and duration thereof? Bro, we'd be on piles of money, but ethically cannot say that. So it's just an interesting kind of line in the sand that he's drawn. Like, got to be strong. You need to have stability, but not too stable. And you need to have mobility, but not too mobile. And then it matters if you have a thick or thin spine. That's where we're at so far.
Yeah. More platitudes. A stronger back is less pain, or people have said things like strong backs, you know, hurt less than weak backs, or all sorts. It's just things that sound good if you don't know anything. because that is not what plays out in actual evidence on this topic. You do not actually need to, you know, materially improve your strength in order to reduce back pain. The objection that I can already hear in some of the listeners' minds is, well, I had back pain and I started lifting and my back pain got better. And that, again, as we've said, there are numerous changes that happen throughout that process beyond just the increase in your strength performance on a particular exercise, not to mention that time has also passed. So there are lots of biological, psychosocial variables, lots of physiologic changes beyond just your muscles' contractile force output when you get stronger that are probably combining to contribute to an improvement in pain, as well as just the fact that a lot of people's pain tends to improve a bit with time. So it's not that simple as much as we would wish that it were. Because if it were, then, hey, you and I would never experience back pain. And if we did, I'd have questions, really. If approaching, 700, 800 pound deadlift, how much stronger do we really need to get to make this to go away? And how on earth is the rest of the population managing?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So far I've had multiple cringe moments in the podcast at this point, maybe visibly. I think on my podcast react video, they're just my face, just terrible. And then I got a side eye because he says that you got to place the tongue on the roof of your mouth to put the head in a safe and neutral position. And I'm like, wait, what? Like he's reading from a teleprompter clearly. And I highly doubt that he wrote the script that he's reading from. But like, how can you read that with a straight face? That right there, that's next level. Like, can you imagine saying that out loud and not laughing?
I did have a chuckle at that. I think my favorite line came a bit later that we'll get to in a bit. But I appreciate that was yours. Just nonsensical.
Yeah. So again, to be clear, 100% made up, 100% made up. And again, it's fine to speculate, but you need to caveat that, hey, what I'm saying is speculation. And here's why, I'm saying that. Or if there's no reason you're saying it, it's just a thought that I had. And that I would be less offended if that were the case. But yeah, so he goes through the curl up, the side plank, the bird dog, again, excruciating detail on how to perform these things. And then I think it's just worthwhile of us weighing in on our thoughts on these big three. And for me, I think that these are fine entry points if that's what the only things that some people can do or are willing to do for whatever reason, not because of any particular mechanical properties of the exercise, meaning the range of motion, the muscles being used, the movement pattern, anything like that. But if they have some understanding around these big three and they're bought into it and they're like, yes, this is likely to help me, and these are the only things I'm willing to do from a movement standpoint, great, start there. But in my estimation, these represent a sort of way to isolate or target the trunk, the areas that you're having pain directly, and so can serve as a sort of desensitization of particular movements, whether that's spinal extension or spinal flexion, rotation, not in these particular cases, more anti-rotation with the side plank. But that would be either a warm-up or a more effective exercise forms, which again is going to be resistance training to tolerance based on what you are currently able to do. If somebody was like, the only exercises that I can do are side plank, bird dog, and the curl up, I might try to hide a side eye at that point. Cause I'm like, if you can do those things, you could probably do other things that are more effective for not only maintaining current levels of fitness, but potentially improving them depending on your previous level of training, but also would be more useful from a global standpoint of returning you to previous levels of function. So I wouldn't stop with these big three, but if these are three exercises that somebody is willing to do and will do, I could think of worse options. I could also think of other options that are equally as useful. The whole point is, are these big three uniquely beneficial for individuals with low back pain? And to that, I would have to reply, no, they're just three exercises that somebody could do, but there are many other options too. Does that summarize kind of your thoughts on this too?
Yeah, I agree. If somebody was very, very attached to them, I would be curious as to why. And mm-hmm. because, these exercises are wrapped up in a broader narrative, right? The broader narrative being promotion of spinal stability and stiffness and mobility. And these exercises are specifically designed and targeted towards those outcomes. And Huberman spends a long time talking about what are the most common mistakes, quote unquote, that people make while doing these movements. You have to move in a very particular way and not do this thing or the other thing. And similarly, again, all of that is made up. He says, there's this one exercise that you would do for five repetitions. Ideally, you could do four if you wanted to. And I'm like, where did that come from? This is there's no exercise in existence where I'm like, well, the ideal outcomes come when you do this for six reps, but you could get away with five and you'd be all right. the amount of just confabulation around this stuff is pretty irritating to listen to. And again, you would only notice it if you knew anything about this topic. If you don't, it all sounds good. Of course, stable spine, strong spine, muscular spine, stiff spine.
Mobile spine.
Yeah, all things that sounds great. Thumbs up, right? But as far as their actual relationship with, you know, treating back pain, not really any, this has even been looked at. There's systematic reviews on spinal stabilization exercises in the context of low back pain, not particularly useful, you know, compared with any other form of exercise. And this is kind of why we keep coming back to ideas of figuring out an entry point for the person, not for their spine thickness or their wrist thickness or their MRI finding, or, you know, just the, based on the person's experience and trial and error process, figure out how we can get them moving in a way that is meaningful to them, and then try to get them, you know, moving as broadly as possible, you know, generalize that over time, and not making it so like you must fit into this box or move in this exact pattern to get any benefit. I want their movement to be mindless. I want them to be able to move freely and not worry about these details. That's the end goal. And we might take a little bit of time to get there. So that's certainly my thoughts on this. I mean, I've seen patients before who heard about these exercises, and not only did they think they needed them to treat their back pain, but let's say they recovered, they felt like they needed to keep doing them forever to quote unquote prevent back pain from happening in the future. Also nonsense, not a thing. And so it was took a bit of time to kind of mentally deprogram them from that, so they didn't feel like they had to do big three twice a day every day to treat their back pain or to prevent it in the future.
Yeah. Have you ever done the big three?
I believe I might have done a bird dog once. I don't think I've ever done whatever he described as a curl up. And then, yeah, nope. I've done side planks in the past as part of like swimming training and stuff like that.
Yeah. I've never done a curl up. Well, maybe at a progression to like a hollow body position. Like, I think maybe that's a thing. I'm sure I've done side planks. I can't recall doing bird dogs outside of a demonstration to somebody who was asking, but yeah. And somehow have been able to manage 38 years of existence, you know, with relatively fine. So he goes from here, and then he starts going into other sort of different treatment modalities and such. But again, and I had more side eye, Oreo analogy for the back. You got, you know, the funniest part about the Oreo analogy to me was when he went off on this tangent about how, like, he, you know, Oreos probably aren't good for them and he doesn't like them personally. It's like, okay. Sick, yeah. Man. Great. And then he's like, you know, the vertebra, the bony vertebra are like the cookies, the black part, the cookies. And then the disc in between is like the cream, right? And a lot of back pain, he says this, has to do with compression or impingement of the nerves based on that cream filling moving in one direction or another. And it's like, you sure? Because like when this has actually been studied, and it has been a number of times, so the when patients present to their primary care physician for low back pain, right? That means that their back pain is bad enough that they're worried about it and they've accessed the medical system on some sort of, you know, on a formalized level. Any ideas what percentage of those actually have abnormalities on imaging?
Well, a fair amount have abnormalities on imaging. I'm more familiar with data on like actual quote unquote like discogenic type back pain out of that kind, which is like 5% or less, something like that. Yeah.
Correct. Yes. Which means that 95% do not have any evidence of disc, quote, disc abnormality on imaging, which just directly refutes a lot of back pain has to do with compression or impingement of the nerves. And this doesn't mean that if you herniate a disc that you're no more likely to have low back pain than if you don't have a herniated disc, especially if it happens suddenly. We're not saying that, because that is definitely a real thing that happens. It's just that that's not what's happening most of the time, right? So when people say, oh, a lot of back pain has to do with this, or the majority of back pain has to do with this, or back pain is from, you know, nerve compression, you know, as he started out this podcast with, it's like, yeah, but it doesn't. So like right off the bat, you're like, so this is wrong just from the get-go. He talks about doing one of the McKenzie exercises, which looks like a, you know, upwards facing dog or the cobra pose or whatever. He's like, yeah, if you do this specific position and you have, you know, a herniated disc that's herniated posteriorly or laterally or posterolaterally, well, you can adopt this position and it's going to squeeze the disc back in. Which, again, if you're unfamiliar with this information, sounds plausible, but doesn't it sound equally as plausible that like adopting that position, if you have a herniated disc in the posterior or lateral or posterolateral sort of area, that going into more aggressive spinal extension, instead of moving the disc, it would just like squish it even more? because you're, you know, contracting that area of the spine, like, seems reasonable enough to me, which again is why these particular movements are not billed as like, yeah, this is how you squeeze your disc back into place. They're really just exercises to get people to tolerate positions that they need to adopt in day-to-day life. It's a desensitization exercise. Now, whether that's attributable to actual discogenic changes, as you, you know, alluded to, or more of a sort of a tolerance of different positions, I think that is a speculative argument. I would err towards more just tolerance rather than any change in the disc. But yeah, it's just a weird kind of thing to hang your hat on right at this particular point of the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, that's just another movement that if somebody does it and they say, wow, that's, you know, actually feels kind of good. I like how that feels. I feel a little bit better after I do it. I'm like, sweet, let's keep doing that. And then we can see if there's a way to progress and generalize your movements back towards, you know, normal life, rather than saying, oh, I saw this disc change on your MRI, therefore this exercise would be best for you. Let's do it. And because this is going to squeeze your disc back into place, because it is, you know, quite likely, you know, plausible that somebody might do that and be like, oh, that actually feels worse. What am I going to say? Well, the MRI told me that this exercise is right for you, so you better do this exercise, right? Yeah. I didn't need that. I was just going to, you know, still find the movements that are better tolerated, worse tolerated, and kind of tweak the dosing and implementation of them over time as part of the rehab process. I remember reading once, you know, on this idea of like repeated extensions leading to reabsorption of the discs, finding one paper that Dr. McGill himself was a co-author on. And it involved this kind of repeated extension exercise. And they showed that there could be some reabsorption of the discs. What the details of that study was that it was in 5 out of 11 pig spines, there was some reabsorption of material. And so, you know, I don't know that if that's the entirety of the evidence base that people use to make these kind of recommendations. But it's one that I have seen cited repeatedly in this context of, you know, evidence that this can happen. It's like, well, did it in some dead pig spines and hold on, 5 out of 11. Okay. So less than half the time. Let's make this a substantial part of my discussion on one of the biggest scientific platform podcasts in the world on one of the most common problems in existence, low back pain. Seems like my priorities are not where they should be right now.
Yeah, exactly. He does some stuff on sciatica that I'm going to just ignore. But, you know, if you were asking for my opinion on his general take on sciatica, I would say it's garbage. It not only does he fail to define what sciatica is, but he goes on to say this is mostly from disc herniations again, which is not correct. And he makes a weird reference to keeping his wallet in his right pocket. But he comes back quickly to say, well, most of the time I actually place my wallet in my front right pocket. You know, the wallet protocol, I assume, is going to be released here fairly soon. Okay, I just wanted to focus, you know, we've been 40 minutes now talking about this stupid podcast. I want to talk about these weird treatments that he talks about. So even weirder than the big three, which again, you and I would be amenable to if those were the ways that people preferred to use. Although again, if they only wanted to do those exercises, I'd have more questions because I think that would significantly affect their trajectory. But first he starts out with the neck. He says, yeah, I know a lot of back pain, presumably low back pain, is due to weakness of the neck, the upper spinal muscles. And then he goes through this isometric sort of neck exercise. And I'm like, wait, what? Weakness of the neck? Like, where does this come from? Like, where is the evidence base for this? Again, I think this just goes back to that assumption that weak spine causes painful spine. And so that's not just the low back, but presumably then all of the spinal segments. In which case, where's the part on the thoracic spine? I mean, that's closer in proximity. Or like weakness in the sacral spine. Come on, dude. Like, just focusing on the neck? Is this just so you can, you know, tell people more about the tongue cue to the roof of the mouth? And it's like, I'm unaware that genioglossus hypertrophy or genioglossus, like muscular activation, has a significant impact on low back pain trajectory. send me a paper if you find something on that. But did you cringe at all about the neck part, or you just fast forward?
Yeah, totally. I mean, he was talking about certain things relating to training musculature around your jaw and your neck and like holding your jaw in place and doing certain exercises. And it's like, look, if somebody has neck pain and we can get their neck moving around more freely and then that's great. But it's almost framed as not only is this a great treatment for back pain in general, but just like with all these other things, that everybody ought to spend some time doing this. This is worthwhile as a preventative, or nobody's paying enough attention to, you know, neck strength. And I'm like, well, pretty much nobody cares about neck strength outside of, like, you know, combat athletes. Neither, you know, I think you might have played around with a neck harness before. I certainly never have and haven't cared. And so it's just, it reminds me of if you went through like all of his podcast material and like collected all of the protocols that everybody ought to be spending some time doing every day or every week or every month, you would not be able to live.
No, you're a full-time athlete. You're a full-time athlete slash like self-help guru development type thing. But here's the interesting thing. Even if you did all of them, you're still going to be weak and like undertrained and, you know, spending all of your time just to arrive at like mediocrity.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Then he goes on into the foot stuff, your favorite thing. He says that the feet are the foundation of the body, which I suppose is bipedal organisms.
Yeah.
Is probably true. Goes into, again, excessive detail on toe spreading and toe strengthening, making wild claims that if you're unable to splay your toes, right, spread your toes apart, that is an indication of like your access to various motor patterns and like strength and then low back pain risk and trajectory.
This was like my version of your side eye moment earlier. I mean, because he was like, people might be surprised that we're talking about the feet in the context of back pain, but you know, the feet are the foundation of the body. Again, it's like, oh, that sounds like a compelling statement. But I saw two patients earlier today who had horrifically diseased feet, including, you know, complex diabetic ulcers and osteomyelitis and partial amputations. Well, I should have asked them, you know, how's your back feeling? Knowing that the foundation of your body is not in particularly good shape, of course, like, how could you, you know, not have back pain with your foundation? Neither of them have any back pain because this is not as clear of a relationship as you would think. And then, yeah, my side eye quote was, quote, there's some exciting literature starting to emerge about the benefits of toe strengthening and toe spreading as it relates to neurocognitive longevity. I paused that and replayed it like two or three times to be sure that that's what I actually heard. And he's like, and I'm really keeping my eye on this body of research and I'm going to have a podcast coming out on it soon. So I suppose we may be in for a treat on how spreading your toes can reduce the risk of developing dementia or something like that. But
that's, yeah,
this is implausible, nonsensical. And then the last thing on toes is he's talking about how he's been spending a lot more time on his feet and his current project is working to develop the skill to where he can lift each of his toes independently from one another. And he is, you know, but an amateur. He's not yet able to lift, you know, each toe independently, but that's something he's spending a lot of time on. And I'm like, bro,
yeah,
are you for real right now?
Yeah. Hey, look, we don't need to know about your APOE4 gene status. We don't need to know about what your Montreal cognitive assessment score was screening for dementia. I just need to know about your feet. Send me a pic of your feet and I'll be able to risk stratify you. Again, and I don't want to belabor this. He talks about belly breathing, nasal breathing, using a staggered stance for exercises like curls, which is interesting because he makes this claim like that's an anti-rotation exercise. I'm like, nope, still in a single plane. There's no rotation there that the trunk has to react against. So, you know, unless you were doing curls in such a dynamic manner where you're going across your body, going across a plane, maybe then it turns into some anti-rotation exercise, but like not a particularly high yield exercise modification to either strengthen the back or desensitize it in some sort of way. It just, you look like a goober in the gym. Imagine doing like a split stance, like curl, and you're like, oh no, I got to do it like this. And it's like, oh, should you alternate every rep? Every set, got to do an even number of sets. I'm like, dude, what in the world? Goes on, talks about despasming the medial glute via this, you know, top secret exercise, side lying hip abduction. And you're like, okay. I mean, I guess if you want to train hip abduction directly, you could do it some way, but a body weight exercise is probably not sufficient for most folks who are ambulating under their own control. But again, if this is an exercise that desensitizes you to some particular movement, it's not bad. It's just like putting up this exercise or this particular pathology as like, this is what's causing your low back pain. It needs to be addressed. Yeah, it's just wrong. I don't know what else to say other than like, it's wrong. It's not a bad exercise and training, you know, all the different muscles of the gluteal complex. That seems reasonable. But like in low back pain, I don't know that I'm directly trying to target glute med, glute min, glute max in isolation, but I'm certainly doing some sort of hip hinge as far as I can. Biggest thing that he ended the podcast with, and again, side eye, bright eye, like just made me overreact. you got to be aware of your movement patterns. You need to move correctly when you're exercising. You need to sit correctly. You need to stand correctly. I'm like, oh, let's introduce some hypervigilance to positions, right? Make sure that you don't accidentally rotate and flex your spine in such a way that, you know, would lead to injury. And it's like, kinesophobia, anyone? Like, as again, especially if you have active back pain right now, imagine hearing this podcast. Like the first part, maybe you're empowered because you get like some exercises, and regardless of our feelings about them, you're like, okay, well, I'll try these things. Cool. You know what? Maybe benefit there. And then you listen to the end. It's like, hey, but be careful. Got to make sure that you're moving correctly, sitting correctly, standing correctly, breathing correctly, only through your nose. Put your tongue on the roof of your mouth. Otherwise, things are going to be compromised or suboptimal. And it's like, how are people supposed to live like this? And further, even if making all these concessions, someone could make all of these concessions and do them exactly as you wanted to, like, where's the evidence that it actually improves somebody's low back pain trajectory? So less period, you know, missed days of work, quicker return to sport, quicker return to previous activity level, decreased pain levels, like any of that. And it's just, of course, not there.
Yeah, I mean, I alluded to this earlier. This is just precisely the opposite of my goals and intentions when working with somebody who has either acute or persistent pain related issue. I want their movement to be free and thoughtless. That's derived from a quote from a famous pain researcher in the past. But the goal is that you don't need to be worrying about every sort of positional change or adjustment, or, you know, your technique in day-to-day life should not be a constant source of concern or thought. And even if we need to maybe modify some of your activities in the short term now, that's fine. But that would not be the message that I leave somebody with, is you need to be aware of all of your movements. Position every muscle fascicle in the optimal location to mitigate your pain or to prevent re-injury or future pain or something like that. So this is just 180 degrees opposite of my goal when working with people in these types of situations.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about where would we refer people to actually find more information on this. Obviously, we have a ton of material on low back pain. Both of our lectures at Fort Irwin are, like, I think, pretty accessible. Mine is probably more geared towards the layperson. Yours more clinician, but I think watching those in succession would leave people in a pretty good place. We got a number of articles on the website regarding low back positioning during exercise and how that relates to pain incidents. We got a bunch of low back pain rehab material, both free and then like a template if somebody is actively experiencing low back pain right now and wants a way to get into or back to exercise. But in addition, if you're looking for more, I don't know, evidence on like, what do we think causes low back pain? What's the general trajectory? What are some recommendations on management on a broader scale? There are multiple recent, well-written, and importantly, evidence-based guidelines that have been put out. We previously referred to the 2018 Lancet three-part series they had on low back pain, but there's a more recent one from 2020, which is a call to action to reduce low-value care for low back pain. It's an update, which would basically encompass all this bullshit in this podcast. This would all be low-value care, like, yes, maybe no-value care or like negative-value care if it actually like nocebo'd somebody. And then what are the two other ones that you like to refer people to, Austin?
Yeah, the 2023 WHO guideline for non-surgical management of chronic primary low back pain in adults is another, you know, good resource. But our favorite one in recent years that we've talked about and cited multiple times, and I have tried to disseminate to my learners when I can, the 2022 Australian Low Back Pain Clinical Care Standard. Just type those words into Google, Australian Low Back Pain Clinical Care Standard. I'm sure we can provide a link. There's a nice PDF document, well-written, you know, accessible mainly for clinicians, but, you know, I'm sure that it would have some value as well for general population audiences as well. So that's the one I can't recommend highly enough. And gosh, it would have been so nice if somebody with his type of a podcast platform, you know, could have brought on perhaps some of the co-authors of that clinical care standard and disseminated the content from that document instead of what he actually chose to do instead. But
yeah, I'm plus or minus on McGill, although again, you would prefer for him to be very nuanced in his, you know, discussion, because I think that would be a more accurate representation of how he feels versus these sort of sound bites or what people maybe misinterpret from things that he said historically. Although again, even with his most current sort of takes, I think that there is contention there. But that's not the most egregious error. The most egregious error or errors is that, oh, now you're referring to people to Athlean X and Kelly Starrett. And it's like, wait, what? Like, these people are decidedly not experts in the field, right? And so it's like, why is this where you went? You could have typed into your Google machine, which I assume they have at Stanford, you know, I assume you have internet access, and say, low back pain clinical care guidelines, right? Clinical practice guidelines, low back pain. And just a cursory glance at, like, you know, the latest evidence, which he bills himself as being very evidence-based and a good scientific communicator. It's like, yeah, your whole podcast would have changed. But instead, we're left dealing with this bullshit.
I guess we need to come up with a low back pain protocol.
Yeah. All right. Low back. I mean, the template would basically incorporates our you know, protocol, but sure, we can expand.
Yeah. Our protocol would be worry less about all these details. Try to stay active. Talk with a trusted clinician.
Yeah. Keep your socks on so you don't think about your feet.
Yeah. Enough of that.
enough foot stuff. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about these two other recent papers. They both came out this month. All right. So they're very, very current. And I suspect we're going to hear more and more about these things as time passes on. The first one here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast with Dr. Austin Baraki is physical activity and incident obesity across the spectrum of genetic risk for obesity. This was done by Britton et al. It's a research group out of Vanderbilt, Tennessee. It was published in April of 2024 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which you guys are more familiar as JAMA. So some background information. 73.6% of the United States population is overweight or obese, and it accounts for about 400,000 deaths per year. Now, of course, lifestyle change is recommended for managing this, which includes dietary pattern change and exercise, ideally to meet the current physical activity guidelines, which is resistance training, all the major muscle groups twice per week at minimum, and doing about 150 minutes per week at minimum of conditioning work. So the most charitable data that we have on this suggests it works 10 to 20% of the time for folks to lose at least 5% of their body weight. Now, as you go on further in time, that's at 1 year mark. At 2 year mark, that's probably a little lower. At a 5 year mark, it's even lower still. But the best case scenario, long-term weight loss from lifestyle change alone is probably 10 to 20% of individuals. We know that genetics are heavily involved in obesity risk. And we also know that genetics are heavily involved in the response to exercise. With respect to the obesity risk, about 40 to 70% of obesity risk is attributed to genetics, and the local environment likely shifts this towards the higher end in very, very bad food environments that those with a lot of ultra-processed foods containing added sugars, added sodium, added fat, and so on, limited access to healthy foods, limited access to areas that people can be physically active, all right? So again, 40 to 70% of the obesity risk is likely attributable to genetics. Now, prior studies have shown an inverse relationship between genetic risk and physical activity and their associations with obesity, whereby increasing physical activity can help mitigate the higher genetic risk for obesity. What this study tried to do was to identify if individuals who had higher genetic risks, well, if you gave them more exercise, would that make up for their increased risk of obesity? So the study, they used the data set from what's called the All of Us Research Program. So it's just over 12,000 adults with a BMI less than 30 when it started. So these are all individuals without obesity. Some of them were with overweight, but did not have a BMI over 30, just over 12,000 individuals. They all wore a Fitbit for at least 15 days per month for at least 10 hours per day. That's used to get accurate tracking data per month. They also calculated these individuals' genetic risk using a polygenic risk score. If you don't know what that is, there's just many, many thousands of genes within the human genome. And a polygenic risk score means taking the contribution from a number of different genes and coming up with some sort of risk. So it's not just a single gene here. We're talking hundreds of genes, okay? The resulting sample, so all of the individuals that they had this polygenic risk score on based on genetic sampling, and who also wore the Fitbit for at least 15 days per month for more than 10 hours per day. And again, who did not have a BMI greater than 30. Well, that left us with just over 3,000 participants. 73% were women, 27% were men. The median age was 52.7, and it was 95% white. Okay, so that's the demographic that we're looking at here. The median follow-up was just over 5 years. The obesity incidence within those 5 years was 13%. In those with the lowest genetic risk of obesity, and 43% in the highest genetic risk group. The average step count for everyone involved was just over 8,000 steps per day, 8,300 steps per day. the lowest, those who had the lowest genetic risk of obesity averaged 8,500 steps per day, whereas those with the highest risk of obesity averaged about 8,100 steps per day. Both the genetic risk and daily step count were independently associated with obesity. So individuals who were in the 75th percentile for genetic risk had an 81% increased risk of obesity compared to those in the 25th percentile for genetic risk. So if you were in the 75th percentile for genetic risk, just genetically not well suited to avoid obesity, they estimate that you'd have to walk 2,280 more steps per day to level the playing field to somebody with a low genetic risk. And this actually increases with an individual's baseline BMI. So assuming that somebody had an average risk of obesity, 50th percentile, as their BMI goes up, they need more additional steps per day. So if your BMI was 22, you would only need 3,200 steps per day to avoid obesity within the next 5 years. But if you had a BMI of 28, you would need 16,000 steps per day to avoid developing obesity within the next 5 years. Okay. So to me, this suggests that genetics play a large role in both baseline risk of obesity and the response to training. I don't know that either of those are controversial statements, although I think if you're trying to sell somebody an intervention saying, oh, you just have to do this, right? Or if everyone just did this, we would be better. And it's like, not everyone's going to respond the same because not everyone is starting from a level playing field. And again, I don't know how controversial that is. What do you think? Do you think that people will just accept that, or that's somehow super controversial?
I think you're still, no matter how many times we say it or explain it, there's going to be some people who recoil at your discussion around the impact of genetics on obesity risk. There's just always going to be some people who say, nah, it's just me pulling up my bootstraps. But if we Mad Lib this, meaning we take out the term obesity and steps per day and stuff like that and substitute in a different situation, I think we can generate a really clear and obvious kind of case. Let's say hypothetically that with these kind of genome-wide, you know, genetic studies, we're able to identify all of the different genes that can contribute to somebody's muscular strength performance. And we could do a test, calculate this polygenic kind of risk score or a genetic test that basically tells you how genetically wired up are you to get super, super strong. And then we can take two cohorts. We can take that 75th percentile, meaning people who are at the upper end, they're super wired up for strength development, and the 25th percentile, people who are maybe not so well wired up, genetically speaking, you know, in terms of favorable genes for muscle mass and strength and force production and neural output and all that kind of stuff. And then we compare, let's say, how much training do they have to do to get to a 500-pound squat right, or a 400-pound squat or a 300, whatever. Pick your arbitrary strength metric. It is obvious to people that there are going to be those who are very favorably genetically, you know, predisposed, who maybe they can train for 6 weeks and deadlift 405, right? And then there are going to be those at the other end of the spectrum who can deadlift for years and ultimately fail to reach that same milestone, or it may take them, you know, many, 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 many more years or much, 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 much more training volume to get to that same outcome. Here, we substitute back in this study, genetic risk towards obesity development, which is very clearly, you know, shown in the scientific literature. And then we look at those who are very genetically predisposed towards that outcome, or those who are genetically kind of resistant to developing obesity, or who tend to be genetically or quote unquote naturally leaner. People know, you know, individuals in this type of situation. How much work does it take for them to either reach or avoid that same outcome? It's the same kind of concept here. So it should be unsurprising and uncontroversial. Yet for some reason, I suspect that there's a segment of the audience, or probably more likely a lot of people who, you know, don't pay attention to us, who would have no problem accepting the former, the situation where, you know, strength predisposition as a genetic, you know, a factor would have implications for how much or how long somebody would need to train to get an outcome. But when it comes to obesity, they might be a little bit more resistant to that. But that's kind of the way I view this. It's the same scenario, just a different outcome.
Yeah, I can hear it already. People at home are like, yeah, well, our genetics haven't changed in the last few hundred years, and we've had this obesity epidemic. Like, how do you square that? I'm like, yeah, the environment changed. The environment has changed massively in a direct temporal correlation, so time-wise correlation, to the obesity epidemic, and it's exactly predictable. You have a relatively stable set of genetics and an environment that's rapidly changing in a way that is what some have dubbed obesogenic, meaning that you have access to very tasty, high-calorie foods that are not very filling. And when I say easy access, it's not just like proximity. It's also pricing, desirability, marketing, all of these sort of things. That's all changed massively over the last 50 years, which again has correlated almost perfectly time-wise with the obesity epidemic. So,
and that doesn't mean and that doesn't mean that it's not genetics, that it's environment, because these two things interact. And that's how a lot of these kind of conditions, you know, good conditions or disease conditions emerge, as a gene environment mismatch. And if that still remains a little bit unclear, I can still, you know, make up a similar corollary to illustrate this issue. So imagine we have somebody who is a dedicated, you know, powerlifter, or a whole cohort of powerlifters with the current set of average, you know, deadlift or squat performances or something like that. And then we very quickly change their environment. We take them from Earth and put them on a different planet with much less gravity. What is their strength performance going to be? How much weight are they going to be able to lift, right? They have the same genetics, but a different environment. And suddenly, you know, their performance is radically different. If you put them on an environment with really high gravity, oh no, all, you know, look at the rate of decline of strength in recent years. And then if you put them in a place, in an environment with lower gravity, suddenly performances go way up. Similar type of phenomenon. The genetics are, you know, are what they are, maybe more well adapted for a, you know, an environment that was more prevalent, you know, couple hundred years ago. And then the environment changes radically. And suddenly that mismatch between what they were adapted slash evolved for emerges with either new conditions that are favorable, like if gravity goes down, suddenly, oh, sweet, we can all deadlift 1,500 pounds, or a mismatch that leads to worse situations, like increasing obesity.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Most importantly, I don't think that genetic testing is going to be helpful in like determining this. Like, I don't know what you would do with that information, you know, and further, if it would be a surprise. What I'm getting at is I don't know that people who would have genetic testing, unless potentially from a very early age, you know, would be able to sort of modify their trajectory in such a way that wouldn't otherwise become apparent to them, right? You're like, oh, I think that I'm maybe genetically predisposed to this based on current status. It's like, yep, probably. And in fact, I would bet significant amount of money on that. And further, even if you did know your genetics beforehand, right? And like, you're like, well, I'm at risk for this. The fact that that would change behavior, particularly because most food-related behaviors are made subconsciously or at least initiated subconsciously and have a lot of other sort of factors in there besides just willpower and habits and such like, stuff like that. I'm just unconvinced that that would make a big change. You know,
yeah, I'd be more concerned about misuse of the genetic data turning into like a Gattaca Westworld type dystopia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yep. And then as far as, you know, would exercise recommendations be, you know, benefit from knowing the sort of genetic risk somebody has for obesity? I think you could make a case for like increasing the exercise recommendations to folks who are at high risk. But again, I don't know that you need a genetic test to do so. And on top of that, like the exercise guidelines right now, in my estimation, are quite low. Like, you know, in fact, if I was forced to like make an exercise recommendation myself for the population, as far as like, what do I think would significantly or maximally improve somebody's health trajectory, I'd probably double the physical activity guidelines and feel pretty confident that that's like enough for the vast majority of people to sort of check the box from exercise and be like, you're definitely doing enough at this particular point, provided you're actually, it's well dosed and well, well programmed. But I think even if you had genetic risk data and you were like, yeah, you're going to need a little bit more exercise, it's like, great. So how do you operationalize that? Like, how do you get people to then do it? You can't get people to do it, you know, as it is right now. So I think just behavior change is more complex than knowing a genetic risk, but I suspect people are going to get some polygenic risk score for obesity anyway. And then, you know, if that leads to behavior change, great for the subset of folks who would do that. But I do worry about misuse. Okay.
Yeah. I have no further comments.
All right. Last study, and then we'll wrap this up here. Episode 290. Dude, we're getting close to like 300 mark. Should we do something for 300?
Yeah. Just shut it down.
Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is nearly here, which means that warmer, sunnier days are calling. fuel up for them, and support your fitness goals with Factor's fresh, never frozen, dietitian-approved meals. Factor is America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service and is much healthier than most takeout meals, which tend to be very high in calories due to both the portion size and the ingredients. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the takeout trap, and let Factor do the work for you. Now, Factor has options to help fuel you up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. They're ready in 2 minutes, and they even have protein plus options to make sure each meal has at least 30 grams of protein in it. This summer, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered right to your door. Ready in just 2 minutes, no prep, no mess. Head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, last paper is titled National Taxation on Sugar-Sweetened Beverages and Its Association with Overweight, Obesity, and Diabetes. This is by Sassano et al., a research group out of Rome. This was published in April 2024 in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. All right, so some background information. The average American currently consumes about 13% of their daily calories from added sugars, which come mainly from five different food categories: sugar-sweetened beverages, desserts, coffee and tea, candy, and breakfast cereals. Now, sugar-sweetened beverages account for nearly 60% of added sugar consumption in adults. And this is problematic because humans typically do not compensate for the calories contained in these beverages by consuming fewer calories in the meals throughout the rest of the day. A well-studied Tanzanian hunter-gatherer population called the Hadza gets about 15% of its average year-round calorie intake from honey, so that's sugar, plus fruit sugar on top of it. And while this approximates the U.S. sugar intake, the Hadza do not exhibit obesity, diabetes, or cardiovascular disease. So I say this just to say that it's not necessarily that sugar is the actual problem here. I just think that added sugar, as it's currently being delivered to most developed countries, developed populations, including the United States, that's the bigger issue here. So I don't want to demonize sugar per se, but the way it's commonly consumed is through sugar-sweetened beverages, number one, and then two, through these ultra-processed foods that are, again, very high in calories, very tasty, but not very filling. In other words, we tend to consume the same amount of calories that we normally would throughout the rest of the day, despite drinking a sugar-sweetened beverage, which can lead to spontaneous increase in overall calorie intake. This is a primary reason why sugar-sweetened beverages are so consistently associated with obesity and adiposity-related chronic disease. Now, in response to these findings, the 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans advise that individuals should reduce their added sugar intake to less than 6% of total daily calories. It's reasonable to advise individuals to shift towards a dietary pattern that limits added sugars, especially from sugar-sweetened beverages, and replacement with calorie-free, artificially sweetened beverages is preferable based on existing evidence for safety and efficacy. Now, tax laws are a method that have been used and implemented in order to reduce sugar-sweetened beverage intake. Evidence shows that about a 20% increase in the price can lead to a reduction of sugar-sweetened beverage intake by about 20%, thus potentially reducing the burden of obesity and type 2 diabetes. So this particular study reviewed the effect of 76 separate tax laws issued between 1940 and 2020 in 43 different countries and how they affected incidence of obesity and overweight, if at all. So this study, they took data regarding the prevalence of obesity, overweight, and type 2 diabetes from the World Health Organization database, and they used 57 studies that incorporated 76 or assessed 76 different tax laws. This included 53 different countries worldwide. Half of them were high income, one third were upper middle income, and the rest were from lower middle income. Only one low income country was included, that was Rwanda. The oldest laws were in Finland from 1940, which is surprising. Like, just imagine what was happening in 1940. You know, you've got like World War II going on. And like, I think at that point, soda and sugar sweetened beverages in general were like a novelty, almost like, you know, people were not having these things regularly, but the Finnish were like, nah, dog, we're taxing these things. I wonder, I'd be curious to know how that legislature came into place. But most recently, 56 of the 76 unique tax laws were introduced between 2011 and 2020. Typically, these were increase in price for beverages containing a certain amount of sugar. The majority were based on the volume of the beverage, so how much you were getting, and a smaller amount were the tax laws actually increased the tax that people had to pay based on a higher sugar percentage. The highest taxation was found to be applied by the country of Tonga, also in Norway. These are greater than 100% of the actual purchase price of the sugar-sweetened beverage. But still, we're talking about a few bucks in United States currency. Results-wise, obesity, overweight, and type 2 diabetes prevalence rates still increased over time in these countries, but generally decelerated in adults and children, although there was a stronger decrease in children. So this just means that the rates continue to increase above where they started the assessment at, but they slowed down a little bit, and that slowdown tended to be a little stronger in children. Unfortunately, there was less than a handful of countries that actually showed a decrease post-tax intervention, like two or three, as I recall. There was not really a clear effect on how the tax laws differentially affected different countries based on different levels of national income. Rather, the tax design itself was more important, with larger taxes seeming to produce bigger change, although the data is relatively limited here due to the heterogeneity in different tax laws. My thoughts here is that this scoping review found that close to a quarter of countries worldwide had implemented some sort of taxation policy addressing sugar-sweetened beverages, and that there was a relatively small effect, so some deceleration, that was seen overall. This small effect, because it wasn't a slam dunk, is probably due to latency of the effect, meaning that most of the tax laws were implemented relatively recently, so enough time hasn't passed to really see a big enough effect. But again, it's probably more effective in kids. Now, if I had to argue against myself, I could say, well, maybe there's some potential input of reverse causality here, which is making the overall effect relatively small. Like, people were not drinking as much sugar-sweetened beverages as before, although I was unable to find any data suggesting that that is like a secular trend, because in general, sugar-sweetened beverages, that consumption has gone up. Overall, to me, this needs more study, and the small effect that was seen here speaks to the complexity of the food environment. So even if you like tax the sugar-sweetened beverages, like, people are going to get the added sugar from other places. So it may not be a big enough effect to see a large outcome benefit in a relatively short period of time. I would definitely recommend to reduce sugar-sweetened beverage content. And Austin, I think that's probably one of the first things you address with your patients when it comes to dietary patterns. How does that conversation usually go? You just say, hey, you having any sugar sweetened beverages?
And then it's usually part of just my dietary history. And so I'll start out with a conversation of asking about, tell me about, you know, a typical day of eating, what that looks like for you. And usually I'll get some like very general type thing. So I'll probe for a little bit more specifics, or I might ask them what they ate today or yesterday, and you know, get a sense of how often they're, you know, eating takeout food or food outside of the home. And then, yeah, any sodas or any other kind of calorie containing drinks besides just like water, tea, black coffee, stuff like that. And trying to get a sense of, you know, on an individual level, how big of a contributor do I think this is to this person's situation? Sometimes I have somebody who's got, you know, been dealing with obesity for a long time, and they don't drink any sugar sweetened beverages, but their, you know, issue comes more from other types of food sources or from alcohol or something else. And so I'll just target that. So to your point, I mean, taxing sugar sweetened beverages or sugar, it does seem to have an effect. This has been shown in plenty of places around the world. But since that alone is not the sole cause of obesity, I wouldn't expect, you know, a gargantuan decline in obesity after instituting something like this when there are many other variables at play. Just like if we're trying to pass some kind of policy to mitigate back pain or something, there's not like one thing that you can attack to like markedly reduce the prevalence of this very, very common and multifactorial issue.
What do you think the U.S. public's reception would be, or temperature, if you're taking their temperature on like a sugar sweetened beverage tax? What do you think?
I mean, this is, I don't know that they've tried to do a specific, you know, well, certainly not anything federally. This has been done more at a local state type level.
Yep.
And I remember when it happened in New York, and of course there's this whole blowing up thing about, you know, nanny state government and the governor's trying to take away your big gulp and things like that. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty counter to the American brain for sure.
Yeah. I mean, there's been multiple examples of when the government has had to step in to like save us on some level from ourselves, like seatbelts, you know, for example, or like fluoride in the water. And it's like, okay, like were people actively pushing back against these things? Like,
yes.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, they may have been. I wasn't around. And so I would assume that if we try to, A, we're going to put a 100% tax on sugar sweetened beverages, we're also going to eliminate them. You can't be in schools. So no sugar sweetened beverages in schools, right? No sugar sweetened beverages in hospitals. Like what? Like I don't know. And you can make a number.
And then marketing as well, like that aspect of things, marketing, advertising to the public.
Yeah.
I think that in general, you know, nowadays, of course, we have this, you know, new world of, you know, obesity medications and things like that that we use to treat like individual by individual on a person level. But accepting those. Or except for those in general, the interventions that are likely to have the biggest effects are much higher, what we call upstream, higher up food environment, which we've talked about before, on a population level. But since, again, so much of the public, at least here and in a lot of other places too, is pretty resistant to such things, that's why, unfortunately, in many situations, we're relegated to having to use medications and things like that to facilitate it, even if they are not ideal in many ways either.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But maybe, you know, I'm optimistic. Maybe we'll find the magic bullet to adjust the environment, and you know, everybody will go on and live happily ever after. We'll see. That'll be on episode 291. Thank you guys so much for listening to the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Again, this is episode 290, our April 2024 research review. All the resources that we discussed in this podcast are listed in the description below, so check those out. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.